You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 3rd, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, folks.
And joining us as a guest rogue this week is James Randi. Randi, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Good to be here, Steve. Always good to be here.
So we're going to start by Evan telling us what is special about today.
Well, today is March 3rd, and it was back in 1915 that the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics was founded. NACA, N-A-C-A. And this is the predecessor to NASA.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So why'd they change it?
Actually, in 1958, on March 5th, it was decided that the concentration would not just be on aeronautics, but also space endeavor and space exploration. It took them a little while, but that's how it evolved over the years. And the mission statement for NACA was, "It shall be the duty of the Advisory Committee for Aeronautics to supervise and direct the scientific study of problems of flight with a view to their practical solution."
Very nice.
Wow.
NASA's a better acronym, though.
Yeah, it definitely sounds NACA. Much cooler.
I agree.
And didn't they? They didn't actually say NACA. They said NACA, right?
Yeah, because NACA sounds stupid. Well, Randi, before we get into the news items, give us an update on how you're doing.
I'm doing very well, guys. I must say, I'm a little surprised myself. I just finished 6 months of chemotherapy after having an operation to remove a nasty bug in my gut. And the operation was nothing. It was one of those laparoscopic things where they make minimal insertions. But I must tell you, I now have three navels, and it's sort of embarrassing, you know, because I never know which one to contemplate.
Right.
Would it have been a lot quicker and easier just to do psychic surgery?
Yeah, well, there's that too, but I thought to myself, no, I shouldn't endorse these quacks out there. I could take advantage of them later on behind closed doors. But the chemotherapy actually went very well for me. And as a matter of fact, I put a thing on YouTube, which you may have seen, where I talked about my chemotherapy experience. And I handled it very well. And one of the reasons was, well, two reasons, major reasons, was I had the right attitude. I went in and determined that it was going to work for me and that I wasn't going to take any nonsense and feel sorry for myself. Second thing is I had the very best medical care that I could possibly imagine. A very, very compassionate group of nurses and doctors that looked after me for the six-month period. I went in every 2 weeks to see to have a pump attached to me, and I had to carry that around for a couple of days in my pocket, and that put the poison into me. Because that's what it is. They poison you to the point of almost dying, but not quite. But the cancer multiplies at a different rate. It has a different metabolic rate. And so it snaps up all the bad stuff and dies. Ho, ho, ho. Fools you.
Right.
So it worked very well for me. I recovered. I had a PET scan. And that PET scan showed I didn't have any infection still in my body from cancer cells or anything. It's all clear, 100%. So, hey, I'll live for another 100 years at least.
Awesome. Great. Can always hope.
Excellent. Randi, did the chemo make you more tired, or did it, did it change how acute your brain was working, or anything like that?
Yeah. I noticed it, and as you might suspect, I was rather observant of that because I found that my short-term memory was incredible. I would leave my office and walk to the other end of the foundation to go into Linda's office, and I'd stand there in the door, and she'd say, "Have you done it again?" And I'll say, "Yeah." And I had to go all the way back into my office, look at the computer screen or look at the desk or whatever, say, "Aha." And then I had to repeat it to myself all the way into Linda's office so I wouldn't forget it again. So it was amusing in some ways, but it all came back, and there's nothing permanent from it at all. Up until a couple of days ago, I had rather numb fingertips, and I was having a hard time doing up buttons, but that's pretty well gone now, and I'm testing my fingers right now. Hey, they're working. Look at that. And there are 1, 2, 10 of them all together. I just check every now and then.
So long as that's how many you started out with,
yeah.
That's good.
Yes, I am traditional in some ways, you know.
Well, this is the first time, Randi, that you're going to be joining us as a guest panelist. Actually, that's not true. It's the second time. You were a guest panelist on our first Dragon Con live show that we did.
If you That's right. I remember that.
Yes.
And DragonCon's coming up again, and I'm going. Wow.
That's right. Yeah, in the fall of this year. So let's get on to some news items. Jay, you're going to tell us how the recent earthquake in Chile has actually altered the Earth's rotation.
You know, I think I was one of the few people that didn't know that an earthquake could actually have an effect on the Earth's rotation. And when I found out, I was like, wait a minute, you know, that actually changed the Earth's rotation? But yes, it did. So let me just give you the backstory. Last Saturday, there was indeed an incredibly powerful earthquake that happened in Chile. It was an 8.8 on the Richter scale, and that ended up being the fifth strongest earthquake ever recorded, which, you know, it's huge. 8.8 is a massive earthquake. And the earthquake actually shortened the length of the day by 1.26 millionths of a second.
I thought yesterday was a little short, you know?
Yes.
So there was a few more stats that happened because of that. So it said that they estimated that the Earth's axis was shifted 3 inches, which is 8 centimeters, which I thought, you know, that's not insignificant either. Right? I don't know if that actually would play out to have an effect on anything real, like weather or anything else, but that's pretty significant. And upon further reading, I found out the reason why this happened was the type of earthquake that we had is called it's called a thrust earthquake. And that means that a large section of the Earth's surface bumped into and went underneath another section. So the two tectonic plates, you know, bump into each other. One of them goes up, one of them goes down. And that's called subduction. And that can also cause volcanic eruptions. But basically, you know, that movement of mass moving from more on the surface of the planet to, you know, further into towards the center, nowhere near the center, but, you know, just moving, you know, on the skin of the apple even a little bit down could actually change, you know, the balance of the planet, and the rotation is 100% tied to how the, you know, the planet is balanced like that, and that's what did it.
Yeah, I find that very difficult to believe, though, folks. I really do, because, look, part of the Earth is raised and part of it is depressed. But the same mass is there in the same relative position to the center of the Earth, it seems to me. Maybe I'm looking at it incorrectly. I don't know.
Well, I guess the question is that the case, or has a little bit of the Earth consolidated or moved a little bit closer to the center without being balanced by another part moving farther away? If that did happen, and that's what this guy is saying, that in fact NASA announced, then, you know, again, the analogy they use is the skater move, you know, bringing their arms and they spin faster, conservation of angular momentum. It makes sense. That would speed up the Earth. I suppose it really ultimately is a geological question as to how the mass of the Earth gets redistributed as a result of an earthquake.
Yeah, I agree with Randy. Like, it doesn't seem to me that intuitive that an earthquake could do that. You know, shifting around of... Yeah, and this has been going on obviously since the beginning of, you know, since the beginning of things changing on the surface of the Earth like that.
Yeah.
You know, like, I guess if this is true, then the relative speed of the rotation of the Earth is always in flux.
How does this mass of material that is shifted around compare to the total mass of the entire Earth, though? That's what I don't get. You see, it's such a tiny, tiny percentage, a fraction of a bit of a percentage. I just can't see it. Again, I'm just having a hard time with it. But I'm not saying I doubt it. I just have a hard time accepting that somehow.
Yeah, it is extraordinarily small. I mean, the crust is really just a thin, thin layer on the outside of the Earth. But don't forget, to balance that, we're talking millionths of a second. So that's kind of equally as small. That's kind of how I see it, that the mass is relatively small, but we're talking also the tiniest sliver of a second.
But the other wrinkle here is that we can only measure the rotation of the Earth to within about 20 millionths of a second. Damn impressive, but not precise enough to actually measure this shortening of the day, or this increase of the rate of the rotation. So we can't actually verify this empirically, is the bottom line.
That's not good.
Yeah, we can't measure the rotation precisely enough to do that.
But Steve, they're making claims that the Earth actually shifted on its axis as well. I mean, and that seems extraordinarily measurable.
Yeah, you think so, because astronomical observations would check that out right away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read that as well, but again, that is such an extraordinarily small movement of the axis.
Was it eight centimeters? Three inches. Or, I mean, but that, or, you know, but like Randy said, though, you know, but you multiply that times millions of miles when you're, you know, when you're observing something that far away, that turns into an incredibly huge amount of a change, right?
No, I don't think it works that way, because we're so far away from everything. The amount of parallax or what have you that would be generated by that is so insignificant. I bet you we couldn't detect it.
Are you and your science?
So this one is interesting. I mean, it's an interesting concept. I mean, it seems legitimate in everything they're saying. The question is, just geologically, does that actually happen? And it would be interesting if we could get to the point where we could actually empirically verify it.
There's also something about it that just rubs me the wrong way.
Well, it's because you don't like to think of the Earth as not being fixed and dependable, and, you know, the idea that our axis and rotation could be altered by something like this is a little disheartening.
Yep.
Well, we're going to do a quick follow-up on Darwinius, also known as Ida, which we were thoroughly unimpressed with as a science news item last year, and we were not alone. And Bob's going to tell us about some scientists who are shooting down the claims that were made for Darwinius even further.
Yeah, you guys remember Ida, all that hubbub last year. It was an interesting story. For me, this whole topic kind of split up nicely into three pieces. I call them the good, the bad, and the ugly. Darwinius Macaulay, is that how you pronounce it, Steve?
I have no idea.
Okay, I'm going with that then. Darwinius Macaulay, that's Ida's scientific name. This was a beautiful, by all accounts, 47-million-year-old primate fossil that was preserved with unprecedented detail, which is especially important for primates, because generally primate fossils will just pretty much just leave teeth, and you have to become an expert in teeth if you want to be an expert in primate fossils. So this was really an incredibly well-preserved fossil. So good, though, that people are saying that it's the most complete fossil primate ever found. Not only did it have a complete skeleton, but the soft body outline was visible, and even the contents of its last meal. So this was really a splendid fossil that really should not have anything taken away from it. So that was the good. The bad started when the team of scientists that announced it got ahead of the science and really overstated their theory that Ida was a link to two major branches of primates, one of which includes humans. So that for me, that was they were really a minority. I mean, that was their theory. This was their research, and that's fine. But that's where things kind of started to go sour for me. And then the ugly began with the media blitz that surrounded it and the hype that was totally crazy. They not only did they have the announcement of this fossil, but there was a 2-hour History Channel documentary, there was a book, a multimedia website, an exhibit in the American Museum of Natural History, and on, and all of this was arranged and planned beforehand.
Yeah, this was an extreme example of something that frequently annoys me about the way science gets reported, and I think it's a problem of both the scientists and their PR offices, if they're at a university, and the media, is that a scientist will often present their opinion as if this is now the accepted fact or consensus of the scientific community.
Right.
And, you know, so I never know exactly how much they're at fault for that versus the reporters that are doing this story. But that always annoys me when they do that. Then you get this minority opinion presented as if it's the consensus opinion. And this is a good example of that, but here the scientists were clearly at fault.
My pet peeve with this was the whole usage of the word link and missing link. You really, you know, the scientists might not have really promoted that word or that usage, but the promotional materials, it was all over the place.
Yeah, but we're stuck with it.
I know, but it was, to me, it was the last straw for this stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, the same way that it gets you riled up, it also captures the attention of the general public. And that's why, unfortunately, the scientists and their publicists went with publicity over scientific accuracy.
Right, but
screw the public.
It wasn't so much the fact that they were selling this as a link, but that they were saying they were emphasizing the connection to humans.
Right.
When, in fact, even if they were correct the link to humans was very tenuous. It was just two branches of primates millions of years ago, not having anything directly due to humans, except we're primates in one of those groups. But in fact, it probably wasn't even that. And Bob, that's what this new publication is about.
Well, just to finish the quick sum up here, that like we've been saying, a lot of scientists reflexively kind of pulled back in disgust with all this Hollywoodized treatment of the new discovery, because basically their biggest beef, I think, was that there was no scientific debate yet. I mean, how could you present this stuff as fact when debates really got to come first? So later last year, last October to be exact, there was a proper scientific rebuttal to all this, and this was formulated by Dr. Eric Seifert from Stony Brook University. He concluded that Ida was not part of our ancestry. He said that Ida looks like other fossils that have been shown to be related to lemurs, not apes and people. So now, just in the past few days, we have probably the most devastating blow yet to the original theory. A report by a team of scientists in the Journal of Human Evolution, they went over all the original descriptions of Ida's anatomy one by one, point by point, and they came to the same conclusion as Dr. Eric Seifert, and that Ida came from an extinct lemur lineage and not the one that led to humans. Chris Kirk had a good quote here. He's from the University of Texas in Austin, and he's an author of this paper. He said that this is just the correction process in science. One group makes extraordinary claims, and other researchers see whether the evidence support them, or as in this case, where it doesn't. So that's pretty much the bottom line. We've got a team of experts that are agreeing with this original assessment from last October that this really is not related to us. This Ida is not our great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, not related to humans at all. And for me, this whole affair was kind of depressing. You got scientists trying to be cool and media savvy to an unprecedented degree, really, and it really did not go over well with other scientists or other people who are familiar with this. And it's really what should have been a glorious celebration of this beautiful fossil just turned into this epic science fail that was just very disappointing.
What's crazy is, though, that the media often portrays controversies in science when they're not really there. Or they'll take like a situation where there's a 95% consensus
agreement.
Opinion and a 5% minority opinion, and they'll present that as a controversy. But here, there was an actual real controversy, and they should have presented it that way. You had two alternate interpretations of this fossil. It was too early to say that there was a consensus one way or the other, and it was really an unknown. It was a very interesting question, and that's how it should have been presented, not just here's the one interpretation and that's it.
But they seem to have taken a cue from the pseudoscientists who skipped the process, mm-hmm. and instead of going through serious inquiry,
that's what I
go
thought.
Right
that's
to
what
the
I
media.
Thought. I thought cold and, fusion all over. And, here we go with cold fusion again.
Hines and Fleischmann, you got it right there.
Yeah.
You know, my opinion has always been that the media just doesn't give a damn in general. They want a sensational story. They want something that's going to get people's attention. It will make a headline, and if they can get some sort of minority opinion, as long as it has a PhD after it or something like that, no matter how well-earned that PhD might have been or whether it applies or not, they will publish that because they want a sensational story. They've got to grab people's attention. And they really don't give a damn, as I say.
That true.
Certainly seems that way, although I do think that scientists bear part of the responsibility for interfacing with the media properly and teaching them how to tell the story. Sometimes it's worthless, it's pointless. You know, the media, you know, by the time they're talking to me or to a scientist, they've already made up their mind. They're looking for sound bites. But sometimes you have an opportunity to actually control the story, and scientists need to take that responsibility seriously. Let's go to the next story. This one's the kind of story that comes up often. This is one of those stories that when I first heard it, I believed it, but now I'm not so sure. Have you guys read this story about raining fish in Australia?
Yes.
Yes, I have.
I have not.
Well, I mean, it's plausible in that, you know, basically hundreds of perch fell down in a small, remote Australian desert town, stunning local residents. And yeah, like Steve says, these things do come up quite often. There's there's a big precedent for raining animals. If you just look at plagues of frogs and things like that. And it's been explained as, I think the best explanation that's been offered is that water spouts and, you know, heavy winds that can pick up certain amounts of water along with the animals, take them up, freeze them, and then, drop them several hundreds of miles away. But of course, this has never been scientifically tested and it hasn't really been properly observed. Although I wonder what the scientific testing of such a thing would look like. I imagine PETA would protest.
Sure, another thing you've got to bear in mind here is that water spouts do get picked up in the atmosphere and taken hundreds of miles away. They don't have any fish in them, or frogs, or other animals, or human beings, or anything like that. And when that falls, people say, oh, it rained. You know, there's nothing unusual about it. But if it should happen to have some solid contents in it, it gets people's attention.
Right.
Here's my problem with the story, though, is that the eyewitnesses were recounting that the fish were all alive, flopping around on the ground. And I just can't imagine how the fish would survive that whole process. And what's their terminal velocity? I mean, what speed are they going to be hitting the ground with?
Well, what if instead of being alive, they were bouncing, and that might have looked more like, you know, fish flopping about to somebody who was,
or
just
some sort of post-mortem, you know, neurological phenomenon going on.
But wouldn't Twitch. They be splattered if they were?
Well, they're kind of rubbery, aren't they?
Velocity.
Not if the wind was sort of picking them up and, you know, if they were dropping straight down with no wind, yeah, but
it depends depends on how hard the ground was and where are the video cameras?
Frozen the fish were.
Where are the video cameras?
That's number two, Jay. I've looked and looked and looked. I could not find any actual video or pictures of fish or frogs actually falling from the sky. It's always eyewitness reports. And the alternate explanation, I think, to me, seems more plausible, and that is that the fish are coming with the rainwater from either dry lake or riverbeds or muddy riverbeds. Now, these were spangled perch, which is the most common freshwater fish in this part of Australia. And what I learned about them is that they are able to survive an incredible range of environments, and that they have been reported to survive on the bottom mud of damp leaf litter or in the bottom of lakes when they dry up, that they are often found in huge numbers right after a rain without, you know, an apparent explanation. So in fact, there's a theory that has not been verified that they may actually be able to go dormant in the dried out lake beds, or they may be able to leave their eggs behind. But even without that piece, it has been verified that they can survive in the mud at the bottom of a dried up lake. So it makes much more sense to me that this kind of fish who happens to have this ability and exists in this region of Australia, you know, the rains come and they get all washed out of the dried mud at the bottom of the rivers or lakes, wherever they were, wash across, you know, this town. People see them flopping on the ground in the middle of nowhere and assume that they fell out of the sky, even though they didn't actually see them falling out of the sky.
Well, maybe, though, could they survive if they can survive at the bottom of a dried out lake bed? Maybe they can survive being frozen for a short period of time.
Those are two very different
frozen
things.
Fish.
I have a harder time believing that fish can be sucked up into the upper atmosphere and stay there for a long time.
Steve, are you insinuating that these are time traveling fish?
if I could see a tuna doing this, or a gefilte fish, for example, now that would convince me right there.
Yeah.
if a bit of salmon fell on my bagel while walking around outside, that to me.
Well, or if they fell on the LHC.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Well, that would break it and cost trillions of dollars.
Or a whale and a bowl of petunias.
You know, the
another thing I'm not too happy about with this article is that, you know, the reporter did like half an article here. If I was the reporter on this, I would definitely dig deeper, speak to a scientist or a dozen, you know, like find out like what some plausible explanations are or whatever. But just to put this out there and not give any explanation whatsoever is not good reporting.
Well, they often throw out the water spout thing.
The article we're looking at is from the Daily Mail. And, you know, I've only been here in England a short time, but let me tell you that the Daily Mail is the biggest piece of crap on the newsstands.
That's a technical description, isn't it?
Yes, that's actually their slogan, biggest piece of crap on the newsstand.
Okay. But actually, the story comes from the Northern Territory newspaper, which has a similar reputation to the Daily Mail. And one of the commenters to the article said, this story is coming from this paper, and they regularly tell stories about zombie cats or whatever, you know, that all kinds of crazy stuff. It's not really a reputable source.
Okay, you know what? We need our buddies in Australia. We need Dr. Rachey and Richard Saunders to go to this town and do some investigation.
The town, did you mention the name? Lajamanu. Yeah, maybe Lajamanu.
I don't know.
And the environment. There was a few towns around it, too, that also had similar reports. So
it's between Darwin and Alice Springs.
we need some on-the-ground, first-hand skeptical reporting on this story, I think.
Yes.
I don't buy it, though. All right, well, let's go on and talk about the use of acupuncture for depression. Now, Randy, if I recall, you told me previously that when you were in the hospital, you were offered acupuncture for some of your medication side effects?
Correct, yes. And they got that from NIH, National Institutes of Health, brochures and such. And almost every one of the NIH brochures now mentions, sort of parenthetically, a tacit endorsement of acupuncture by saying, you may want to ask your physician about the possible use of acupuncture, which has been deemed in some cases to be efficacious when treating the side effects of chemotherapy. Now, this is a very muddy statement. It's very vague and whatnot, but anything that appears in an NIH bulletin or a pamphlet or a book of any kind, and believe me, I have investigated all of these over the past few months, that even gives any sort of mention to acupuncture other than to say that it's not dependable and doesn't have any proven track record is very dangerous, because an acupuncturist that I ran into, I went into his office, as a matter of fact, to get instructions, and I saw the guy was an x-ray technician who was on the side, an acupuncturist, and I picked up a piece of his literature, and it said right inside, as mentioned in the NIH bulletin, and I quoted the bulletin, acupuncture has a side treatment for side effects of cancer. And that can be fatal. Now, I wrote away to the NIH. I sent them certified letters and whatnot. And for the longest time, I didn't hear anything. But I finally got a very brief statement from them. He assured that the NIH does not endorse the use of acupuncture. Well, then stop mentioning it.
Right. No, I agree. It's a tacit endorsement. And that's coming from the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, which is a center within the NIH. That's why these positive statements are coming out. The NCAM, they take a very celebratory and promotional tone towards anything complementary and alternative, regardless really of the state of the evidence. It's one of
very
our
true.
Primary criticisms of them. But I may be having an opportunity in the near future to discuss that with the director of the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine. So I'll definitely give a report on what comes of that. But
well, Steve, you could tell her that Randy and I are really pissed off about this.
Okay.
I am. I'm doing a major piece on it in my next book, which is in the computer at this moment. And about one-third done. It's called A Magician in the Laboratory. And it's going to be hot, I'll tell you that. It's going to get a lot of attention, and I'll be getting hate mail for the next 3 years after it emerges.
Hate mail's always good.
You'll be getting plenty of love mail, too. I think I just heard, I just heard 60,000 SGU listeners squee in anticipation and delight.
Is that what we call that noise I make whenever Randy writes a book?
Yes. Squee!
So no, I can't talk about every acupuncture study that comes out, but this one has been getting a lot of attention, and we've gotten a lot of emails about it, so I thought I would talk about it. This latest study is acupuncture for depression during pregnancy. And they did a reasonable job of trying to be rigorous, but they just didn't quite get there. It's a smallish study, about 140 some odd people in three arms. So you're getting, you know, a little bit less than 50 people in each of three arms. One was acupuncture tailored for the treatment of depression and also tailored for the specific person in the trial. The second group was acupuncture not tailored for depression or that person. And the third one was massage, which was kind of a silly control group, in my opinion, to have. And what they found was that the reduction in depression was statistically significantly increased in the depression acupuncture group, the treatment acupuncture group, but not the control acupuncture group or the massage group, which were not different from each other. So, of course, that creates a round of acupuncture works, you know, in the media, which, you know, the big problem there, the meta problem is, again, we talk about how poorly a job the media does in reporting science. They always report single studies as if they give us some definitive answer, and they rarely do. Single studies are only meaningful when put in the context of plausibility and other clinical evidence, and there have been about 30 or so studies of acupuncture in depression, and guess what? The results are negative or uninterpretable. So far we have a fairly large body of evidence with thousands of patients collectively, basically negative. This one study doesn't alter it that much, but there are some significant problems with the study.
Another thing, too, in the research for my next book, which I just mentioned, on the acupuncture thing, in contacting the NIH, I did get one massive set of materials from them with 308 scientific papers, and I use that expression in quotations here, scientific papers that investigated the use of acupuncture for various purposes, mostly for pain relief and such, and particularly for the side effects of chemotherapy. And of those 308 folks, 8, count them, 8 out of 308 were positive. The rest of them either are disqualified because they're not double blind or because the sample size is something like 8 persons or something of that nature. Absolutely insignificant. But 308 papers and 8 of them are positive? Come on.
Yeah, and there have been systematic reviews in acupuncture, and they all come out negative. I mean, there's been no replicatable effect, consistent effect of acupuncture for anything. So it's a lot like the ESP research, where there's always a positive, crappy study to promote in the media, but nothing that could be replicated.
So, Steve, out of the 308 studies that Randy is referencing, what would be the number, say, of something that does prove to have an effect? Like, would we be in the 20% range of positive studies, or, you know?
I would be ecstatic to see a 20 or 25% positive results from something like that, but, you know, 8 out of 308, I'll let you do the mathematics, it's just ridiculous. And the fact that most of them were not done double-blind at all. They did no attempt whatsoever to do them double-blind.
Well, it depends on how you're looking at it. If you're looking at all of acupuncture, you know, that's a different kind of question. You're just saying, what's the state of the research in general? If you're asking about a specific question, does acupuncture work for depression, you want to see more positive studies than negative studies. Or you want to see that the better studies tend to be positive. If you see a pattern of mixed results in the less rigorous studies and then the best studies are negative, that pattern tends to go along with a non-effect, an effect that's not real or nothing greater than placebo. And that's basically what we see with acupuncture, like, and homeopathy and similar implausible treatments.
Well, the reason why I ask is I just want to put what Randy said actually is very powerful, but I want to put it in perspective. So, you know,
I think the perspective to put it in is that there's a lot of crappy research. And then when you filter those out, then what you're left with are the best studies of acupuncture, which consistently show that it doesn't matter where you stick the needles, it doesn't matter if you stick the needles, that there's a non-specific placebo effect, and that's it. Now, or you know, the studies that purport to show a positive effect beyond placebo have serious methodological flaws. And that's where I'm getting to in this study, because, again, we've got a lot of questions about this study, because it seems superficially rigorous. But the problem is that the way they blinded the practitioner was that they had senior acupuncturists who were experienced designing the acupuncture treatment for each individual person. And they designed a real one and a fake one, so they wouldn't know which. And then they had a junior acupuncturist with less than 2 years of experience administer one of the two acupuncture treatments according to the way that the person was randomized, and they allegedly didn't know which treatment they were giving, the true one or the fake one. The problem is when they then assessed the treating acupuncturists, the ones that were treating the patients in the treatment group, the one getting the depression acupuncture, had a significantly greater expectation of benefit than in the other groups. So clearly the blinding didn't work. The treating acupuncturists were not. So it wasn't a double-blind study. Mm-hmm. And that right there is enough to explain. Actually, the other thing you have to put into context is the effect size clinically significant. And it really was just barely. They're using a depression scale that goes from 1 to 22 is severe depression. You know, broken down in, you know, non-depressed, 8 to 13 is mild depression, 14 to 18 is moderate. More than 23 is very severe depression. And here, the difference between the treatment and the control group was about 2 to 3 points. So you take, say, 3 points. That's not even one grade, you know, in terms of like mild to moderate on this scale. So not terribly significant. So small number of subjects, small effect size. The unblinding of the acupuncturist is probably enough to explain that. And certainly in the context of negative systematic reviews and really no plausibility, this is not a very compelling study. There's a couple other minor problems that I think also add up to some significant methodological flaws. The groups were not comparable when they went into this study. So the people in the control group had more chronic depression than in the treatment group, therefore might be more resistant to treatment. And also, they didn't stratify to race, which is just odd because that's so standard to do that. When you stratify, you make sure that you get the same number of either sex or race in the different groups. And it turns out that there were more African Americans in the control group than in the treatment group. Now, normally I wouldn't make such a big deal out of that, but cultural beliefs surrounding acupuncture and just getting stuck with needles is pretty a large effect. So I couldn't find anything specifically documenting this, but it certainly is plausible that African Americans aren't as keen on getting stuck with needles as maybe Caucasians or Asians are. So if that is an effect, that's also a potential confounder in this study. There also was a pretty high dropout rate of about 23%. So, you know, small study with a 23% dropout rate is a little problematic as well.
In the 308 cases that the NIH presented to me, I found out that some 30% of them were acupressure, acustimulation, acutouch. This is all touching traditional acupuncture points, or rubbing them, or just tapping them.
Yeah.
Which has nothing to do with acupuncture whatsoever. But they counted anything that started with ACU as being acupuncture, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a big problem, too, in the CAM world, is mixing different modalities. My biggest bugaboo with acupuncture is the electroacupuncture, using electrostimulation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's actually really doing something, yeah.
Yes, it actually does something, does it not?
Yeah. I mean, that's TENS, transcutaneous electric nerve stimulation. I mean, that's an actual proven treatment for pain. I always liken that to, like, injecting morphine through the acupuncture needle. It's not acupuncture. So anyway, superficially seemed like a rigorous study, and the authors oversold the conclusion, which is not that uncommon, even in less controversial areas, when in fact it was a weak study with some significant methodological flaws in the background of, again, negative systematic reviews. All right, one more news item before we go on to a couple of questions. Evan, you're going to tell us about a haunted hotel.
Yeah, this is a real quick story, but it showed up in USA Today, so you know it did get some certainly national attention. And the story is titled "Haunted Hotels: Ghost Stories Can Be Good for Business." And what the reporter did is basically went around and interviewed lots of people staying at various hotels who have, you know, basically ghost stories to tell about their experiences that they've had staying at various hotels. In some of the cases, there have been reports of famous people or professional athletes that have come clean on their experiences that they claim to have had in hotels with things that they, you know, certainly can't explain. The gist of the article gets to the point that the ghost business, you know, is perhaps a means of profit for hotels. It's a way to help, you know, sell your hotels because, frankly, there are a lot of people out there nowadays who are, you know, more curious than ever about the paranormal, about ghosts. They see these shows. There's so many of them on television. They, you know, they want to have their own paranormal experience. So, you know, hotels are, you know, starting to promote the fact that they've had these claims from some of their guests, and they're using that to, you know, try to attract more people to come stay at their hotels.
And also, beware of the expression that they have no explanation for. That doesn't mean there isn't an explanation, because old hotels tend to creak a lot. Maybe you've noticed that. It's like old guys like me. I creak a lot, too.
But maybe you're haunted.
Steve, you once said there are no haunted places, only haunted people.
Well, I stole that from Joe Nickel, though.
Oh, okay.
But it's true. It's the perfect quote. And also, what the article quotes one of the like curators of a hotel who's been working there for 15 years and never saw anything. And that's what we hear over and over again. The people who actually work in the hotel are there for years and years, never see or hear a thing.
But well, that's because they're insensitive, though, you see.
Well, yeah. But by sensitive, we mean not fantasy prone, right? But the people who want to have the experiences or are predisposed to the experiences, they stroll in and on their first night they're seeing ghosts. The guy who's worked there 15 years, nothing. So clearly it's very person specific, not location specific.
You know, when we talk about ghosts quite a bit on the show, it's a you know, a hot topic of paranormal discussion and skeptical discussion. We rarely talk about it in the context, though, of it being, you know, a money making venture. It always has been, probably.
It's
right?
An industry now.
Yeah, it really is, and not even just recently. I think you could make an argument that for hundreds of years, you know, people have been, you know, fortune tellers and seers and all these other people who practice, and they depend on there being the belief of ghosts out there. Otherwise, they're not gonna make coin.
Evan, right? it's as old as man, you know.
No, I would also say that Joe Nickel and I would agree. I'm sure that we might just suspect that there are some people at 2 o'clock in the morning wandering up and down halls and scratching on doors, just to keep the reputation of the hotel going.
Absolutely. Right, sure.
Yeah. Yep.
But I think even broader, and Evan, your point is that the paranormal itself has always been an industry, a moneymaker. You know, it's not just people who are interested in it and want to believe. It's people making money off of it as a phenomenon. Going back to the spiritualists of the 1800s.
Yeah.
That was an industry,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that's taking advantage of people who, you know, for one reason or another, just doesn't know any better. And I think that's the nefarious part of it.
Yeah. And speaking of Joe Nickel, he actually tells a good story about the fact that a lot of it comes out of the carnival culture. It has a lot to do with carnies, which is all about making money off the gullibility of your marks, right? That's what the whole culture is.
Right, that's exactly right.
Well, it's time to play Who's That Noisy? Take it away, Evan.
I love playing Who's That Noisy, and you do too, whether you like it or not. So, with that, let's... here is last week's Who's That Noisy? All right, you guys remember that?
Yes.
Kind of sounded like a lion, but I gave the hint that it wasn't a lion.
Yeah, okay, so it wasn't a lion.
Any guesses?
So it actually was a lion.
No, it was not a lion. I'd be lying if I said it was a lion.
Yeah, it's a sea otter.
Liar.
No, not a sea otter.
A sea lion.
A sea lion?
No, not a sea lion.
A dandelion.
Dandelion, close.
A dander.
That's an elephant. That is a bull elephant, if you can believe
Whoa.
It.
Whoa.
Isn't that amazing?
Did anyone guess that?
And someone did guess that. I couldn't believe it. James from Houston, Texas, wrote me an email and said, "This week's Who's That Noisy is the growl of an elephant." And that's all he wrote. And I replied to him and I said, "That's amazing, James. How did you know that?" And he said, "Oh, I just hang around the zoo a lot."
Wow. That was his answer. I hang around the zoo a lot.
Not quite.
Oh my god.
He listens to nature documentaries and television shows and so forth. So he recognized it from those.
All right.
And this was in fact pulled from a National Geographic.
But he's
program.
Not an elephantologist, though.
No, he's not a tuskologist or a trunkologist. Or a pachydermologist. Well done, James from Houston. You go.
A pachydermologist?
Isn't that what they're called?
Did you just say you go? Did you give him three snaps up when you did
it? Yeah, that's really... You're going back to the 80s with that.
I was very impressed. Very, very, very impressed by James.
All right. What do you got for this week, Evan?
Well, this week... Look, I decided I wanted to follow it up with... Yet another similar themed.
An Who's That Noisy? Animacule?
Yeah, so give this one a listen, all right?
That's an elephant.
No, last week's was an elephant.
I know, but that's what
it sounded like.
No.
It sounded like two different animals at once.
No, that is not an elephant. That is a different animal.
Okay.
How I like different? The animal ones, actually.
I do, too. Give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
Let's do a couple emails. The first email comes from Russell Bell from Houston, Texas. And Russell
Yeah, Houston!
Writes, "What is the difference between skeptics and contrarian? I am really interested in improving my awareness. The rhetorical techniques used by others to manipulate the unknowing and gullible are my call to arms. Can you and will you give me some assist?" So thanks for that question, Russell. This actually comes up quite a bit. I have to say that I most often encounter what I perceive as the difference between a skeptic and a contrarian when a contrarian is accusing me of not being skeptical. I would distinguish those two as, you know, a contrarian is someone who takes either the minority opinion, the contrary opinion, if you will, the out-of-the-mainstream opinion for its own sake, or has an inherent bias against accepted or conventional wisdom. Whereas a true skeptic, in my opinion, is after the truth, whether or not it's the accepted opinion or not. Sometimes, you know, the conventional wisdom is correct. And if it is correct, if the logic and evidence supports conventional wisdom, then that's what we go with. We don't take the contrary view just because it's contrary.
Yeah.
Would you say that that's also like being, you know, playing devil's advocate?
Well, I mean, I would say contrarian. I mean, playing devil's advocate is taking the contrary view just for the sake of argument. And there's actually a lot of utility in doing that if you are in a group dynamics. Mm-hmm. In fact, those who have written about, you know, how to make decisions in groups have suggested that you should actually appoint somebody to be the devil's advocate. But in order to avoid the pitfall of having a bunch of yes men, basically, you need somebody to say, your job is to shoot down our ideas and take the opposite side, to force us to discuss it and defend it, rather than, you know, we may all just go with the group mentality otherwise. But I think that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about somebody who
does it because they feel more comfortable in that position or like that, right?
Or, yeah, just, you know, we encounter these people all the time. They definitely exist in skeptical circles. I think oftentimes contrarians think of themselves as skeptics. But they would, you know, take, for example, the view that, you know, evolution's not true because all the scientists believe in evolution. So, you know, if you accept that, you're drinking the Kool-Aid, or you're just going along with, you know, conventional wisdom or with what the mainstream tells you and not thinking for yourself. That if you're thinking for yourself, you have to disagree with conventional wisdom. But that's a logical fallacy in and of itself. Yeah.
We had an email recently, Stephen, which someone said that, you know, it came across your podcast on skepticism, only to find out that you guys are defending the pharmaceutical industry, right? So they were kind of surprised that we were not taking a skeptical attitude towards, you know, the big pharma per se, you know, and they were kind of expecting us to be that way. So I'd say that's kind of a contrarian attitude as well.
Yeah, I agree. And it definitely bleeds into the conspiracy kind of end of things as well. Like, if you believe anything the government tells you, then, you know, you're gullible. Being skeptical means basically always thinking that the government is lying to you or is engaged in some nefarious, hidden, you know, agenda.
Do you think, Steve, that skepticism or being a skeptic can lead to being a contrarian?
That's a good question. It shouldn't if you're doing it right.
I think, though, that oftentimes, maybe not often, I've seen a lot of people, when they get involved with the skeptical community, they tend to be really excited about it. And so they tend to, overplay their skeptical hand a bit and immediately become sort of contrarian about certain topics.
Yeah.
They go along with their, you know, crowd, which is funny to talk about a contrarian going along with the crowd, but,
with the contrarian crowd.
It's like, and so they, you know, they immediately reject things that maybe they shouldn't. And then they tend to calm down, I think, after a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I went through that. I mean, it takes practice to kind of temper yourself and get yourself into a place where, you know, you're not just like throwing out the information that you have or the skill set that you have as a skeptic and, you know, basically saying, that's crap. You know, you got to.
Right.
You got to be smart about how you handle yourself in situations like that. And I can see where the two can definitely be confused or overlap to a certain degree. Absolutely.
I agree. Yeah, it's easy to overcompensate. You know, it's kind of a sophomoric approach. And then as you mature, you begin to realize that, yeah, you got to take a neutral approach to things, not a contrary approach to things. And you have to be comfortable saying, well, this is conventional wisdom, but this time it turns out to be right. You know, just whatever the facts and evidence say. Let's do one more email. This one comes from Joe P. from who concludes with snowy regards here in Denver. So Joe P. is from Denver. And he writes, "Hi, guys, love the show, changed my life, etc." That's it. We got one etc. from this guy. "I experienced something interesting recently that I do not believe that you have discussed on the show. I work for a healthcare organization that required us employees to go through a series of Enneagram workshops. These workshops delved into our Enneagram personality type and how our personality type shapes our social interactions and outlook on life. My wife is a staff member at a local university, and she had to take the True Colors personality test and attend similar workshops. Many of my friends have also been required to take similar tests for their workplaces, such as the Myers-Briggs test. Two questions. What do you guys think of these professional personality tests? I felt that my personality typing was fairly accurate considering it's a self-reporting questionnaire, but then my type was over-extrapolated with implications that sounds eerily similar to a generalized astrology reading. What do you think these personality tests being used in the workplace? This seems like a bad path to start down. The specific Enneagram I took was in a book," and then he gives a link. I said, "This is a good example of the theory. There was also a Wikipedia entry on the subject." So, have you guys had a chance to look at this?
Oh, yeah.
I looked at it. I really didn't.
I have not.
I did.
Bob was busy with science or fiction. I didn't like the Enneagram. I mean, it went full on into woo.
It's astrology.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just astrology. I mean, I'm not a fan of these personality tests, especially the kind that get used like in the office setting, because it significantly oversimplifies the process. Even though they say they have something like 200 questions for the full test, that's just not enough. You know, the real, like, validated, used by psychiatrists personality inventory is something like 600 questions. And each question is carefully vetted and validated so that we know that it means something. And even then, there are problems with that test. Here we have a shorter test, and you could take an even shortened version of that online with only 36 questions. But it's what's called a forced choice, which, again, is similar to the multiphasic personality inventory, the real one, if you will. But when you do a forced choice, you have to be very careful about the kind of questions that you ask. And here I thought that the questions were just terrible because they conflated independent variables. You know what I mean? They say, would you say that, you know, you like A and B, where A and B don't have anything to do with each other, or C and D? But what if I like A and D? You know, I don't want to choose A and B. So I felt I was constantly being forced into making decisions that were a compromise rather than just focusing on one thing alone, right?
So it's just that's so typical of your personality type.
It was very sloppy.
I think it's not just astrology. Astrology is just a cold reading or just randomness. Here, you know, they are asking you some questions that will have something to do with your personality, and then they basically just feed that back to you. So, you know, if it asks you, would you rather spend the evening alone or with a group of people? And you say, if you say, I'd rather spend the evening alone, they give you the personality type. You're the type of person who likes to spend the evening alone. Say, so, oh, that's very insightful. Thank you. So, I mean, I don't think it goes beyond feeding you back the answers to your questions. You know, and again, and those questions weren't really very carefully crafted. I also don't think that the questions, I think the approach is very superficial. Like the nine different types are the reformer, the helper, the achiever, the individualist.
It sounds like tarot.
Yeah, yeah, this is just, it's really superficial. I mean, it's not, doesn't reflect personality theory or any psychological theory or anything. It's just, it is a cosmopolitan type of personality test, the kind of thing you do at the back of a magazine or something, you know.
What'd you think of the Myers-Briggs, Steve?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, the Myers-Briggs is okay if it's part of a larger suite of tests and if it's used a certain way, but if it gets boiled down to this is your role in the office and this is how you're going to interact with your office mates and it sort of slots people into a label to a type, I think it's crap. I don't think you could apply it that way.
I agree. Yeah. Crap.
Well, so my test results were kind of all over the place, too, when I did it. And, yeah, I mean, some of them, I think, when you read their descriptions, that's where it is very much like astrology, because you could read yourself into many of these personality types. So, like, I think I came out highest on the reformer. Let me read you the description. The principled idealistic type ones are conscientious and ethical with a strong sense of right and wrong. They are teachers, crusaders, and advocates for change, always striving to improve things, but afraid of making a mistake, well-organized, orderly, and fastidious. They try to maintain high standards but can slip into being critical and perfectionistic. They typically have problems with resentment and impatience.
Yeah, and your house is rising in Mars or something.
Right.
That's all that's missing from that.
At their best, wise, discerning, realistic, and noble can be morally heroic. So, you know, yeah, who doesn't want to see the positive aspects of that in themselves? And some of them, well-organized and orderly, probably is not too far off the mark. But again, that's pretty easy to extrapolate from the questions where they basically ask you how well-organized you are, you know.
I have taken the Myers-Briggs. I've taken the full test before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. I mean, I thought it was very accurate.
How many questions was that? Do you remember?
Yeah, I mean, it was probably 100 to 150, I'd say.
Yeah.
And I remember doing a lot of reading about it afterwards because I was really impressed with what I perceive the accuracy of the test.
But see, that's my point, Jay. Accuracy is not really the test of these kind of examinations because you're telling them about yourself and then they're just feeding you back the same information you just gave them. The real test is insight. How insightful was the analysis, not how accurate it was.
Right.
Yeah, but Steve, the questions on this test were not so direct. Like, you know, what, you know, they're not asking you questions about your personality in a manner that seems direct. Like, they're asking questions, engaging your response to those questions, and they don't seem to be like directly related to personality centric questions. Like, you know, what kind of person am I? They don't get into that. Like, they ask you situational questions. What would you do to react to this situation? How do you feel about this situation?
Right.
Yeah.
Find a bag of money on the ground. What do you do? That kind of stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, any time when you're going to have to answer a couple hundred questions about yourself, you're going to be pondering, thoughtful about your how you would react in situations, your personality. I mean, that's always fun.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's probably the main reason why these personality tests are so incredibly popular, because people just desperately want to think about themselves and know more about themselves.
Oh, I see.
And to get some positive feedback as well.
Yeah. I've mentioned it before on the show, but I know it was ages ago, so I'll just say it again. There's a really interesting book I read on personality tests, the history of them and why they got popular and how they came to be. It's called The Cult of Personality by Annie Murphy Paul. So, highly recommended. Interesting read.
Well, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Last week, Jay did science or fiction, and this week, Bob is covering science or fiction. So take it away, Bob.
Oh, crap. Was it my turn to do this? All right. I'm just going to wing it, kids. Wait, give me a second here. All right. Okay, I'm ready. Okay, number one. Fluorescent lighting in supermarkets enhances nutrient levels of spinach, otherwise known as spinach. Number two. Artificial marijuana is becoming increasingly popular with teens in the U.S. It is made of common dried herbs and sprayed with a potent psychotropic drug.
Yikes.
Number three, HCFCs, which have been used for years as a replacement for ozone-destroying CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, slowly damage the ozone layer once a critical threshold amount has been released in the atmosphere. So, Randy, since you don't have Skype, I'm Skyping this to everyone so that they can read it. Would you like me to read them again?
No. I think I got that. And I would think number two. That's what I would guess at.
So the artificial marijuana, you say, is fiction?
Yes, because it's easy enough to find the real thing. It's all over the place.
That's true. He's got a point there, guys.
Great.
This is not from personal experience, mind you.
No.
I was going to ask you for a hookup. All right. Okay, so I will roll my random dice, and Steve, you go. Quick, come on.
All right, let's see now. So fluorescent lighting in supermarkets enhances nutrient levels in spinach. It depends on what you mean by enhanced. Does that increase the nutrient levels from the point at where it was picked, or does it just keep it from decreasing as much as it would were there not fluorescent lighting?
I'm sorry, Steve. No more information could be given to you at this time.
I'm not asking. I'm just saying it depends on how one might interpret that one.
That's a bizarre interpretation. I will go with the former.
Let me go to number two very quickly. While I agree that marijuana is quite abundant, I also think that teens are want to experiment with all kinds of things. So spraying psychotropic drugs onto herbs, it sounds very plausible to me. I heard that they like soak marijuana in formaldehyde to increase the high.
Gross.
It's called an illy, if I recall.
Not from personal experience, though, right?
No, you know, I'm a physician. I have to know these things. And then the HCFCs, which are supposed to not destroy the ozone layer, do once you get past a critical threshold. Again, you know, everything we make is bad, right? So that makes sense. So These all seem highly plausible. I'm just going to go with my gut feeling and say that number one, the spinach one, is the fiction.
And now, let me roll my die. Evan! No, wait! Rebecca!
Oh, you can't change your mind like
what
that.
Is this?
I can do whatever I want. I'm king!
Wow. Oh my God.
This should be called.
He's gone mad with power.
This should only be called Science or Fiction. This is called Bob's Revenge.
Yeah. Okay. Well, artificial marijuana, I've certainly never heard of that term, but spraying things with a psychotropic drug, that does sound like, I think it's salvia or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is pretty popular, and because it's currently legal in some places. So anyway, I think that that's true. And I agree with Steve. It wouldn't be a big surprise to find out that HCFCs can slowly damage the ozone layer once they pass a certain threshold. So, yeah, I'm going to have to agree and say that fluorescent lighting does not enhance nutrient levels of spinach.
Okay, now I will go with, let me think, Jay.
Bob, I had this whole thing planned where I was going to take my time like crazy and like go through painful analysis and play carnival music in the background.
Yeah.
But I'm going to make this easy. I think number one, the spinach one is the fake, and I think that the actual thing is flipped. I think that the fluorescent lights doesn't enhance the nutrients, but it lowers the nutrients.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, as much as in a certain way, I agree with Randy in that there's, you know, just marijuana is everywhere, and you know, do you really need to to go through these, you know, efforts to get something that you could otherwise really get? So that raises a red flag. However, as Steve was saying, enhancing the nutrient levels, that's just too nonspecific. It's too vague. It doesn't sit right with me. So I'm going to say that that first green leafy answer is the fiction.
Okay.
Not the second one.
All righty then. So let's see. Which one?
There.
Yeah, it's over. The fun part's over. Now I got to explain all this. This would be fun too. This will actually be pretty. I'm trying to think of which one do I start with here.
Everyone agrees is true.
Stop bossing him around, Steve.
He asked.
Well, I don't have to do everything you do. I'm just going to go. I'll start with. I'll start with three. We'll start at the bottom. HCFCs, which have been used for years as a replacement for ozone-destroying CFCs, slowly damage the ozone layer once a critical threshold amount has been released in the atmosphere. And that one is fiction! I nailed all of you. I'm just going to like stop doing this now because that was my goal. I said I'm going to do a clean sweep, and I was like half joking in my mind, and I actually nailed all you guys. This isn't hard, Steve. You're crazy. Okay, so hydrofluorocarbons are actually, they were picked because they don't damage ozone, and I did searches. I could find no ill effects on ozone at all, but there are some nasty side effects to HCFCs. Years ago, they came out with some studies that showed that HCFCs are like a super greenhouse gas, 4,500 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And then most recently, they have another study now that's showing another potential problem, that they're saying that there's a possibility now that HCFCs that may break down in the atmosphere to form oxalic acid, which I never heard of before, which is one of the culprits in acid rain. So there's definitely some downsides to using HCFCs, but the effect on ozone is not one of them. So, woohoo! So let's go back to two now. Two, wow. Artificial marijuana is becoming increasingly popular with teens in the U.S. It's made of common dried herbs and sprayed with a potent psychotropic drug. That, of course, is science. It's called K2 or spice.
This fake weed is causing many teens to seek medical help for hallucinations, severe agitation, elevated heart rate, blood pressure, vomiting, and in some cases, tremors and seizures. None of that reminds me at all of what the side effects of smoking marijuana should be. Pretty nasty side effects here. The idea, though, is that they're using common herbs that are legal, kind of like potpourri herbs, that are legal, and you could own them, you could do whatever you want with them, and they are being sprayed with something called JWH-018, which is a synthetic man-made drug, supposedly similar to cannabis. I guess it's supposed to give you some sort of hallucinatory effect, but because of all these other nasty side effects, a lot of people believe now that there's some unknown Agent X being used that's also being somehow, maybe accidentally or maybe on purpose, also sprayed on these dried herbs, causing this nasty stuff. So kids, stay away from the fake weed. Just go with the good stuff. Okay, number one.
That's great advice.
Number one, fluorescent lighting.
And stay in schools.
And read science books.
Be skeptical.
Number one, fluorescent lighting in supermarkets enhances nutrient levels of spinach. Man, when I read that, I was like, yeah, that's going to be the top of my list. The ACS, the ACS Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry reports that fluorescent lighting in supermarkets actually can boost the nutritional value of fresh spinach. Really counterintuitive. Normally, you always think, oh, you know, it breaks it down. It's got to go down, right? It just really didn't make any sense. But they did some studies. They studied spinach stored in light. Now, they were in clear containers, of course. They stored them in common, you know, fluorescent lighting for after 3 days of being constantly exposed, as they are in a regular supermarket. They had significantly higher levels of vitamin C, K, E, folate, and carotenoids. And spinach, the control spinach stored in the dark, had lower or unchanged levels. So the levels actually went up in some of these key vitamins here. So this obviously in the future could potentially lead to improved ways of preserving and enhancing, you know, the value, the nutritional value of spinach and of maybe perhaps even other vegetables. Who knows? That would be imagine you're like, oh, the spinach is, it's not old enough. I got to come back in a few days. So that was a really interesting story, and they didn't really go into the mechanism of how this works, but they apparently are studying this, and it's a pretty interesting study. And hopefully they can really parlay that into something, you know, interesting with vegetables in supermarkets. So that's it, kids.
But, Bob,
what?
If you bathe the spinach in fluorescent lighting, is it still organic? Or is fluorescent lighting
banned? No technology.
It's all natural.
I don't think organic sellers or growers care what kind of light it's exposed to, but interesting story. I loved it.
What if you have radioactivity coming out of the fluorescent?
Yeah, you have to put that funky stamp on it, and people don't like seeing that. That wouldn't be good.
Right.
So, yay, that was fun.
Yeah, good job, Bob.
Good Thank job, you. Bob.
Well done.
I have to leave you folks now, unfortunately, but I would like to read you just one paragraph that I came up with in the side of my car here in the glove compartment. I found a leaflet that we picked up in a restaurant, a Korean restaurant, and it's a leaflet on acupuncture and the local practitioners here. And this question, you're going to love this answer. The question is, what can I expect after acupuncture treatment? The answer, patients often experience dramatic results in the first treatment. Some patients experience an immediate total or partial relief of their pain or other symptoms. This relief may last, and some pain may return. In a few cases, there may be no immediate relief, only to notice the pain diminish over the next couple of days. Generally, you should expect to feel better. I have never heard a more vaporous, vapid answer in my life. You either do or you don't. It either works or it doesn't work. Come on, friends. But this is from an official acupuncture. It was given out in a Korean restaurant, so I'm staying at a Korean restaurant from now on.
Well, Randy, thanks for joining us. We had a great time with you tonight.
Yeah, thanks so much, Randy.
It's been very interesting. We'll do it again when I'm on a little better connection, and next time it'll be Skype, I promise you.
Now, Randy, before you go, though, we're going to be seeing you on April 17th in New York at the Northeast Conference on Science
correct.
And Skepticism.
That is absolutely correct.
So we are all looking forward to that. We'll see you then, and thanks again for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a great pleasure. Good night, folks.
Good night.
Good night, Randy.
Night,
good
night, Randy.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this evening to close out the show?
Large skepticism leads to large understanding. Small skepticism leads to small understanding. No skepticism leads to no understanding. Jay-Z!
Jay-Z?
Jay-Z!
You definitely can fit that in a fortune cookie.
I said, yeah, he's a fortune cookie stuffer. He's a good man. And delicious.
I'm so bad, I have no concept of how to pronounce Chinese writing.
Oh, Jay, you failed us again.
Well, first of all, that's not Chinese writing.
You know what I mean.
That's an Americanization or whatever.
Yeah,
of
that's what I can't
pronounce. We call it bastardization.
But there is an official guide or whatever of how to translate Chinese speech into Western, into English, you know, alphabet. But I think Xi Ji is, I think that's how you pronounce it. Well, thanks for that, Jay. Very good quote.
Thank you, sir.
Bob, good job with science or fiction this week.
You're welcome.
Remember, if you haven't recently checked it out, we also produce the SGU 5x5, a short format single topic podcast. You can get to that on iTunes or through theskepticsguide.org. If you haven't recently done so, please check out the Rogues Gallery, the official blog of the SGU. We also host two other blogs, my personal blog, Neurologica, which covers neurological as well as skeptical and other science issues, and Science-Based Medicine, a group blog dedicated to issues of science in medicine. And I also contribute weekly to Skeptic Blog, which also has other noted skeptics blogging weekly, including Michael Shermer, Brian Dunning, Phil Plait, and others. And since we haven't asked in a while, we do appreciate the support of our listeners. You can do this in numerous ways. Take a look at our homepage at theskepticsguide.org. You could donate your support directly to the SGU to, you know, keep our bandwidth going and keep us producing content every week. If you are from Australia and you'd like to see us down in Australia at the end of the year, you can donate specifically to our Australia Fund. You can also go to the SGU store and purchase some of our swag from Cafe Press. You can also download the Skeptic's Guide Uncut. There are currently 5 episodes up there, with the 6th one being a bundle of the first 5. And these are pay per downloads. It's extra premium content. And that's another way to support the SGU and all of our activities while getting a little something back in return. So thanks for joining me this week, guys.
Sure, it's a pleasure to be with you this week, Steve.
Good episode.
wait. Rebecca.
Yeah, yes, wait.
It's just flat out not the same without you.
Aw, I missed you guys. I dreamt of you all night long.
Did you?
It was sexy.
And you were there, and you were there, and you were there?
I had just come back from Birmingham Skeptics in the Pub, and I was exhausted. So I apologize, but...
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I do, but I can't pronounce the guy's name.
What else is new?
How do you spell it again?
It's X-I space which is Z-H-I.
So X-I, I believe, is G, right?
Or she.
Xeezy.
I thought it was cheesy.
He's a Chinese philosopher.
That's all I got. How about
Oh, he stuffs fortune cookies, I think.
I know, it's Chikizi.